So I'll start with just a kind of historical overview of how the President's Party almost always loses seats in the midterm election, and then I'll go through some of the different ways that political scientists have explained the midterm loss in midterm elections, and then look at the recent polling for the House and Senate races, a little bit on the governor. I'll focus more on Congress, and then end with some predictions about what's going to happen. Okay, so with the historical overview here, going back to 1862, so this is the first election where we have the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. The President's Party has lost seats in all but three of those elections. So 38 midterms, lost seats in 35 of those. The three exceptions are all really historical anomalies. So you've got 1934, 1998, and 2002. So 1934 is the first midterm election with FDR during the Great Depression. And so the Democrats are, you know, a very popular party. FDR won a landslide election in 32, and then Democrats pick up a lot of seats in 34 as well. 1998, anyone remember what that was for the anomaly? It was should be in your recent enough memories with impeachment, exactly. It's when the Lewinsky affair with Bill Clinton, and the Republicans in the House went after Clinton, impeached him, and the Senate failed to convict him. Well, the thing was, Clinton's popularity hit an all-time high, like right when the Republicans were trying to impeach him, because we'd had that, you know, that run of, you know, the best economic expansion we'd had in the in 100 years, and so Clinton was a very popular president. And so the backlash against the Republicans for that resulted in the Democrats picking up seats for only, again, the second time in over 100 years in a midterm had the President's Party won seats in a midterm. And then 2002, of course, is after 9/11. George Bush is president. You have the terrorist attacks on the United States. And so if you don't have a Great Depression, an historic unpopular impeachment, or terrorist attack on the country, the President's Party will lose seats in the midterm election. Now, the only question is, how big will those losses be? Well, the average seat loss since 1906, when the House was set at its current size of 435 seats, the average loss is 32 seats. Well, the Democrats need 24 to regain a majority, so just, you know, if they even don't perform as well as the average, it, you know, looks like they should have a pretty good chance of picking up a majority. Now, we'll look at some other factors in play that might make that, you know, less likely to happen. So that it's certainly a possibility, though. Now, the Senate is much more unpredictable because, you know, only a third of the Senate is elected every midterm election. Because of the six-year term, you only have 33 or 34 seats up in a midterm election for the Senate. So it depends a lot on which seats are up. And so right now, for the Democrats, they have a pretty tough row to hoe in the Senate because they had a really good year 6 years ago. So in 2012, the Democrats did really well in the midterm elections in the Senate. So now they're defending a lot of seats. They're defending, you know, twice as many seats as the Republicans are. And so even if the Democrats do well in the Senate elections, they're not as likely to pick up as many, you know, if any, seats. They'll be, you know, lucky to hang on to all the seats they're trying to defend. So because of that, because it's much less predictable in the Senate, the President's Party still loses seats, but not as regularly. So in the 25 midterm elections since 1914, which is the first year that we started popularly electing our senators, before that state legislatures elected our senators, since 1914, in about three-fourths of those elections, we've had the President's Party lose seats in the Senate. But again, it's not as regular. The average change is under four seats. The range is from a 10-seat gain, again, that historic election for FDR in 1934, to a 12-seat loss a couple of times, both in 1946 and in 1958 for the Senate. So this shows, going back to that 34 election with FDR, the orange bars are House seat loss, the green bars are for the Senate, and you can see that, you know, you have some, you know, really you know, big changes. The most recent one in 2010, when the Republicans had a really good year, picking up 64 seats in the 2010 midterm elections. But more recently, you can see that the losses have been smaller in general for the President's Party than in the previous period. So if you sort of break it at about 1974, you can see that in general the losses were bigger before that than after that. You only have 1994 and 2010, and then also 2006, a good year for the Democrats. 94 and 2010, both really good years for the Republicans, where you get that really big seat change. And then the 2 years I mentioned, 98 and 2002, where you have the President's Party actually picking up seats in those two elections. And again, for the Senate, you can see it does kind of bounce around quite a bit more, and it's unusual to have a shift of more than six or seven seats. That doesn't happen that often in the Senate, but again, you only have 33 seats that are up for election in the Senate. So why is this the case then? Well, there are four explanations that political scientists have offered to try to explain this loss of presidents, the President's Party in midterm elections, and each of them have, you know, some piece of the truth here, I think, in terms of explaining what's going on. The first one has to do with this idea of surge and decline and presidential coattails. And surge and decline refers to this sawtooth kind of pattern we get in turnout in our elections, where people turn out for presidential years, that's the one with the red dots, and then they don't turn out in midterm election years. And this, you know, it's about a 20-point difference in most elections, where, you know, turnout is much higher in the presidential years. So the theory is that this surge in decline that you get in turnout actually hurts the president's party, because the president's supporters come in a presidential year, get him elected, and then 2 years later they stay home. And we saw that for sure in 2008 and 10. It was so clear that's what happened in 2008 and 10. You get, you know, huge turnout among African-American voters and young voters. So the 18 to 24-year-olds normally don't vote at nearly the rate that other, you know, older voters do, but they turned out at a high rate for President Obama, but they didn't show up in 2010 for the midterms. Same thing was true with minority voters who voted in record numbers for Obama in 08, and they didn't turn out nearly as high numbers in 2010. So the 2010 example does seem to be a good example of this surge and decline idea, where the president's supporters stay home disproportionately in the midterm election. So that definitely is part of what's going on here. The second is just a more simple referendum on the incumbent. And I will show you some evidence of that later in the talk, where I show, like, the relationship between the state of the economy and the president's approval. Just those two things alone are really good predictors of how many seats will be lost. And so that's the idea of a referendum on the president, that even if the president's not on the ballot, it's still basically a referendum on, do you think the president's doing a good job? And so when the president's popularity is low, if the economy is hurting, then the president's party really takes it on the chin in those elections. Whereas if the president's relatively popular, like, again, FDR in 34, riding the New Deal wave, and starting to turn the economy around, you know, then the voters will reward the president's party. And then a variant of that is this idea of negative voting, that it's a specific kind of referendum on the president, that people who are more angry about the state of affairs, and if they think the economy is bad, especially, or if they're especially upset with the president, they're more motivated to go to the polls often than the people who think everything's okay. And so it's that kind of negative voting that can turn out people who are voting against the president's party because of this idea of like holding the president accountable. And there's evidence to support each of those theories as well. Now, this fourth one is the one that's probably most speculative, but there's a little bit of evidence, at least for, you know, some more strategic voters, this could be in play as well. And that is this idea of institutional and partisan balancing, that there is evidence that a lot of voters like divided government. They don't want one party to have control of all of government, because, you know, many Americans really don't trust either party. About more than a third of voters today identify as independents rather than Democrats or Republicans. And so those voters are especially likely to not want one party, either Democrats or Republicans, to be in charge of the House, the Senate, and the presidency. So therefore, if they're voting kind of strategically to do this institutional balancing, if you have a situation like we have right now, or like we had in 2010 with Obama and the Democrats, where one party controls the House, the Senate, and the presidency, well, those voters are going to vote against the president's party to try to flip one of those, either the House or the Senate, to give that control to the other party to serve as a check on the president. And so, again, that's fairly sophisticated strategic thinking, and so there's not a lot of evidence that many voters do that. But even if, say, 5 to 6% of voters would think that way, that could be enough to flip some elections. And so there's, again, you know, some evidence that goes on for that smaller set of voters. I would say the first two are the ones that are there's the strongest evidence for, and then that negative voting in some elections, that's relevant for sure. And then for a small subset of voters, that fourth explanation is relevant. Looking just at our most recent midterm election, just looking at what happened in that election, just as kind of a sort of precursor to 2018, it was a good year for Republicans. It was not an historic year like 2010 was. It was a good, solid win for Republicans, picking up 9 seats in the Senate, that's big for the Senate. We said the average is 4 in the Senate, gave them the majority of 54 seats at the time. Picked up 13 in the House, which is smaller than average, but still increased their majority in the House. But for governorships, they had the largest number of Republican governors in the United States since World War II, 31 Republican governors, the most state legislatures controlled by Republicans in 100 years. And so they've been building on the success of 2010 with the additional gains then in 2014. And the idea of the midterms being a referendum on the president, it definitely was true that Obama was a drag on Democrats, especially in the South. That his popularity had lagged by that point, although it was still higher than Trump's is right now. That Trump's popularity is at pretty much record lows for a first-term president. And so while Obama certainly didn't help Democrats, it wasn't probably as big an effect as Trump might have this fall. But the thing that really hurt the Democrats, I think, was this low turnout. That you had turnout of only 36%, which was down 4.5 points from 2010. And Republicans tend to do better in low turnout elections. They tend to have more loyal voters who go to the polls more regularly, whereas Democrats are more reliant on voters who aren't quite as dependable in terms of going to the polls. But then another thing that people noted about 2014 is that it really was an oddly issueless campaign. There wasn't any big set of issues that really drove the election, and it really seemed to be more just a rejection of Obama and the Democrats rather than endorsement of Republicans. And so sometimes this is referred to as the 6-year itch of an 8-year presidency. That sixth year of an 8-year presidency can be really tough for the president's party. And so when you look at it in that context, the Democrats actually did better than a lot of other presidents' parties have done in that sixth year of an 8-year term. And so it was, again, a good quite as much as had been in other elections. This shows the turnout decline being the lowest that we'd seen since 1942 for a midterm election. And so that my guess is that's going to bounce back up more to the traditional level of 40, the sort of low 40s. I would guess in this election turnout should return to the more typical level of 40-45%. This shows the state-by-state breakdown. You can pick out your state if you want to find out where you are. I gave a talk at University of Texas, El Paso, about a month ago on this topic, and they were a little embarrassed to find themselves down there at the very bottom in turnout. So Wisconsin, I'm proud to say, is up there at number 2. Wisconsin always is in the top 3 or 4 in turnout. Usually it's Maine, Wisconsin, Minnesota, or right up there, Alaska, Colorado, were in this that midterm election as well. And then this map actually shows the changes in turnout. It's kind of interesting to look at it in a map. And the Nebraska had the biggest positive change, and then Wisconsin and Louisiana were the other two that were around a 5% gain. But almost every other state had a pretty big drop in turnout from 2010 to 2014. And so this was, again, something that really helped Republicans, I think, and not sure why it's doing that, but in 2018 if turnout is higher. Now this is another map that I think that both parties are very sort of interested in analyzing in terms of thinking about the 2018 midterm elections. And this shows the shift towards Republicans in 2016. And so this is something that reveals kind of the core of
that Trump base of Trump supporters, that if the Republicans want to hang on to the House and Senate, they're going to need to hang on to that Trump base in the upper Midwest especially, and then also in the Appalachian states where they did very well in turning Democrats, you know, to the Republican Party. On the other hand, if Democrats want to do well in 2018, they need to bring those voters back home. And so if you see the darker the green, the bigger the shift towards the Republican Party away from the Democrats in 2016. And you can see where the concentration is. It really is, you know, the upper Midwest, and then across, you know, down into the Appalachian states and then up into, you know, New York, Pennsylvania. But the rural counties are especially, you know, the places where the Trump voters had that big shift from the Democrats to the Republicans in 2016. So I think those are going to be some of the key areas in the fall elections is, you know, are those Democratic voters going to come home and vote the way they had for many years, or are they going to stay, you know, on the Republican side and continue to support Republican candidates, even if Trump isn't on the ticket? And here's where this idea of the election being a referendum on the president is going to be key. Because, you know, will the Trump supporters still stick with him and vote for Republican candidates even without having Trump on the ballot? Okay, so the next things I want to do then, and this is kind of the outline of the rest of the presentation, we'll start with an overview of the governors and Senate races. First, a little detour to talk about the validity of polling, because a lot of what I'm talking about for the rest of the talk is based on polls. And I know a lot of people are very skeptical of public opinion polls. I'll just talk just a little bit about that. And then focus on the generic House polls, the predictive power they have. There's a survey that's you know, are you going to vote for a Democrat or Republican for the House? And they have pretty good predictive power in terms of saying what's going to happen in the fall. And then other forecasts based on presidential popularity and real income change. And then this idea of the enthusiasm gap. This is something that's based on that idea of negative voting, that, you know, Democrats appear to be more upset about things right now than Republicans, and it appears to be motivating the Democratic base in the way that it's not motivating Republicans. So I'll give you some evidence about that from special elections we've had so far. So first, this idea of you know, can we trust the polls? And so especially after 2016, a lot of people just were ready to give up on polls. They said, well, how can you trust polls anymore after they all said that Clinton was going to win and Trump ended up winning? Well, one thing you need to remember about the polls that everyone was looking at, those were national polls. And Clinton did win the national vote by almost, you know, like 2 million votes. And so what the polls were predicting actually turned out to be true, Clinton winning the plurality anyway of the popular vote. And they were within the margin of error for sure for the national polls. So the national polls were actually pretty close to their historic average. They were off a little bit, but like by about 2 points, which is within their margin of error. So those were okay. What was off were the state polls. And the state polls really were off. And Wisconsin was a good example of that, where there were like 55 or 60 polls that were taken between Labor Day and Election Day in Wisconsin. And Clinton led in every one of them up until one single poll at the very end, finally had Trump ahead. And so the state polls were off, and they were outside the margin of error off. And so pollsters are still trying to figure out exactly what happened there and why that was. And so that is a very strong caveat here in terms of the state polls being off. But on the other hand, the national generic polls are more like the national polls that showed Clinton winning, which she did, again, win the popular vote. And so those polls, I think, we can have more confidence in than some of the state-level polls. But even there, the state-level polls have performed pretty well. And here's the evidence on the state polls in terms of bias. And so if you look at the bar chart to the right, it shows the average statistical bias in polls conducted in the last 3 weeks of the campaign going back to 1990. And you can see that there's, you know, it goes back and forth between, you know, sometimes it appeared the Democrats were doing better in the polls than they ended up doing. Sometimes it was for the Republicans. And in general, there's no systematic bias there.
And overall, the average bias is less than 3%. And so that's not bad. That's within, again, about the margin of error of most a typical poll. And if you look at the state polls, and you can see in the 2014 midterms, there was a bias in favor of the Democrats, and that's the four-point bias you see down there, which is the biggest bias since 1990 in favor of the Democrats, was in 2014. And you see that the state polls were off. They were all showing Republicans doing worse than they ended up doing in every state except for Michigan, Minnesota, New Mexico, New Hampshire, the only four states in the Senate races where the Democrat actually did a little bit worse. In every other state, the Republican had done worse in the polls than they ended up doing. And so, but that, if you look at the rest of the years, though, that was kind of an anomaly. Again, that was the biggest Democratic bias that we'd seen since 1990. And so the problem, of course, is you never know for sure, like in a given year, is it going to be one of the years that tended to favor the Republicans or tended to favor the Democrats? It doesn't seem to be any systematic pattern in terms of the out party or the president's party, and so you can't say that that's what's going on here. And so in general, then, that it means that, you know, over time, the polls are going to be pretty accurate. And so it does, I think, it's the best evidence we have anyway of what's likely to happen in the fall. And so you always have to have that, you know, a little bit of caution when you're interpreting polls, but at least if you look at the historic evidence, they're a reasonable set of things to look at. So with that, those caveats in mind, here's where things stood as of a couple of days ago, before, I think it's about 4 or 5 days ago is when I got this information. This comes from Real Clear Politics. There are a lot of other websites that do similar kind of poll aggregation and rating the races. Well, right now you have they say there are 8 toss-up elections. Democrats are favored in 44, Republicans are favored in 48. And so you can see how tough a task it is for the Democrats to regain control of the Senate. They basically have to run the table on the competitive races. They have to win 7 of those 8 toss-ups because they have to get to 51 to be able to have a majority, whereas the Republicans just have to get to 50 to get a majority. Because the vice president breaks the ties in the Senate. And so if the Republicans have 50, they get majority control. So Democrats have to win 7 of those 8 races to be able to win majority control. And that means, you know, North Dakota, Missouri, Indiana, Tennessee, West Virginia, which West Virginia now, they had the primary there about a week ago. And the Democrats were hoping that this one Republican would win who was, really... He had gone to jail over a previous problem he'd gotten into, and he was trying to get the Republican nomination. Well, he finished 3rd, so Democrats are upset about that. And so now Joe Manchin in West Virginia is probably going to have a very tough race there. Florida Republicans look like they have a pretty good shot to win Florida. Indiana, North Dakota. So it'll be tough for the Democrats to win 7 of those 8 races. I think, if they can win, 4 or 5 of them, or 5 or 6 of them, I would say that's probably the more likely outcome there for the Senate. So definitely not too great a chance for a majority party change in the Senate. Now, on governorships, on the other hand, they definitely will pick up some governorships. Currently, right now, there are 33 Republican governors, 16 Democrats, and 1 independent. And right now, Republicans are favored in only 26 of those races. And there are only 4 toss-ups right now, according to the forecasters. And Democrats actually have reasonable chances in all 4 of those. So you could end up with a 26-23 split with 1 independent if the Democrats would sweep all of those, which is a real possibility. And so there will be some pretty sizable gains for the Democrats in the governorships. And then the House is where a lot of the attention is right now, because the generic polls, this comes from a pollster on Huffington Post showing a 7.2-point edge for the Democrats. And this, each dot is a separate poll, and then the line shows the average of the trend line of those polls. And then from 538 has it at a 7-point advantage right now for the Democrats as well. And so both of those polls, then, and if you do the seat-by-seat analysis as well, and did I get the seat-by-seat analysis? I didn't get that in there. But the real clear politics seat-by-seat analysis for the House shows Democrats like right at the edge of being able to get majority control. You know, they would need to pick up about half of the toss-up races and win the other ones that they're favored to win right now. And so most people put it at slightly better than 50-50 chance Democrats will pick up control of the House. Now, the generic polls, as I mentioned, are pretty good predictors of what actually ends up happening in the election. And so this shows even generic polls 18 to 24 months before the election. And this is the generic poll on the horizontal axis and the actual outcome margin on the vertical axis. And the trend line then is the orange line. And you see that in most elections, you know, there's some outliers off the trend line, but it's a pretty accurate predictor, even a year and a half, 2 years out. And then the final poll, so this is the having the final poll margin, shows that, you know, it's a very accurate predictor of what the vote margin will be. So the generic poll ends up being a pretty accurate predictor. Now, on the other hand, this is just the national vote percentage. It doesn't give us the number of seats. And so to actually figure out who's going to be majority control of the House, you have to translate that the national vote into the actual seats. And here, the Democrats also have an advantage because of the huge number of open seats and the huge number of retirements that really will help the Democrats' chances in the fall. So each one of these different color lines is a midterm election going back to 1974, and the thing that stands out is the red line is 2018. This is the number of days before the election. This was taken about 200 days before the November election, and we already had a record number of retirements at that point. Graph was done right before Paul Ryan's retirement as well. We've had two more since then. And so we're up to a record number of retirements, and we're still 200 days out before the election, and there still could be a few more even that would come up before then. But the most important thing is this, that it shows the partisan breakdown, and most of those retirements are coming in the Republican Party. And you can see that that, too, is a record number, even more than in 94, when a lot of Democrats saw the handwriting on the wall and knew they were going to lose pretty big in 94. And so that, again, with all those retirements opening up those seats, a lot of those are seats that the Democrats are going to be able to have a good chance of picking up without an incumbent running, because it's a lot tougher to beat an incumbent than it is to win an open seat. But here's the big but, is our topic from last night. And this is something that there have been a few people who've made this argument just in the last month or two, saying that process of translating votes into seats so ignores the success of partisan gerrymandering that's been going on in a lot of states since 2010. And so you'd have to win more votes than normal to be able to have a majority of the House seats. And so there was this one study done by the Brennan Center that estimated the Democrats would need an 11-point majority in order to actually gain a majority of the seats in the House. And recall from that generic poll, they're up by 7.5 points right now in the generic poll. And so if that Brennan Center study is right, because of the way the district lines have been drawn, you might need a bigger election margin than would historically have been true because of the way the gerrymandering has happened. And so that 11-point swing is unusually large. It hasn't happened since 1982 is the last time we had a swing of that size in a midterm election. Now, as I talked about last night, the Supreme Court's ruling in the Wisconsin case, the Gill versus Whitford case, could end partisan gerrymandering, but probably not in time to actually influence the 2018 elections, as we mentioned. Okay, so then the last set of things that forecasters look at to try to explain what's going to happen in the midterm elections is this idea of the referendum on the president. And so by just looking at two things, the president's approval and the state of the economy, you can have a pretty good forecast of what's going to happen in the midterm election. And so this shows President Trump's approval rating. Again, using these poll aggregators with the approval rating of average about 42.5%, which is historically low for a first-term president at this point of his presidency. And if you combine that then with the percent growth in per capita income. And this is based on some analysis done by Seth Maskett that uses just the, again, change in per capita income and the president's approval rating. And you can, based on the previous midterm elections going back to the 1930s, these are the trend lines for a 35% approval, 50% approval, and 65% approval, the number of seats that the president's party is going to lose. And so Trump right now, it would be about here in terms of his approval, and income growth is around 2%. And so if historic averages turn out to be true, the Republicans should lose about 40 seats in November, according, again, to the historic averages. Now, that doesn't take into account the partisan gerrymandering, but even discounting, you know, say about, you know, 10, 12 seats because of partisan gerrymandering, you're still looking at a loss in the neighborhood of you know, 28 to 30 seats, probably somewhere in that range. That's what a lot of forecasters are saying right now is likely to happen in the for if you take, again, just these variables into account. Okay, so then the final thing that I mentioned is this idea of the enthusiasm gap. And you know, the idea of negative voting, that the Democrats are more motivated right now because they're more upset. Republicans are either not happy with Trump, some of them, or the ones that are, you're just not as motivated to vote if you're happy with the state of things as opposed to upset with the state of things. And there is some evidence from the special elections we've had so far that show this enthusiasm gap leading to higher turnout, but also then huge swings to the Democrats. You know, the biggest one, of course, was that Alabama special election, that 31-point swing, that shocking election. But, you know, you don't always get the opportunity to run against a pedophile. And so, that's not going to happen in too many elections. And so that is the big explanation there. But then you get things like the Pennsylvania, the Connor Lamb election in Pennsylvania, you know, 22-point swing. This is a strong Trump district. You know, this is a district that Trump carried, you know, easily in 2016. You see a 20-point swing, 22-point swing to the Democrat in that case. And in election after election, even ones that they end up not winning, you still are seeing, you know, 16, 18, 23-point swings towards the Democrats. Now, the trick for the Democratic Party is going to be to replicate this in the November election, when the turnout's going to be higher. A lot of these elections are, you know, relatively low turnout affairs. And so this South Carolina, you know, turnout was only 29% of what the turnout was in the presidential race, 23% in this California open primary. But some of the others were relatively high. So, you know, 3/4 of a presidential turnout is higher than a typical November turnout. And so you'd have to draw a line about there, maybe, to be a typical, you know, November turnout. So that's going to be the test. You know, can they get that kind of enthusiasm for the just regular November midterm elections? And so to end then with just a couple of predictions, it's always a hazardous business to do this, but I do think the Democrats have, you know, slightly better than the 50-50 chance of taking the House, not too likely in the Senate. I'd say that the Republicans probably have something like a, you know, 80% chance of hanging on to the Senate. Democrats are likely to pick up at least 5 or 6 governorships, could go a little bit more than that even, depending on how a few races turn out. We still don't have all the nominees. Like our Republican governor, Scott Walker, is up for re-election, and our primary is not until August, and so we won't know who of the 12 Democrats who are running against him will be the nominee against Walker. And so a lot of that will depend on, you know, what the head-to-head matchups end up looking like. But again, I think somewhere in the range of sort of 5 or 6 is probably most likely. So if this prediction comes true and we end up having a Democratic House, then this is most likely to be the outcome then that we'll have, which is gridlock. but gridlock, I think, would be something that would be welcomed by some people right now, just based on the kinds of laws that have been passed in the last year and a half or so. So I'll open up for questions and talk about any of the specific kind of races if you want to, or any of the forecasting models or anything along those lines. So open up. Yeah.
Right there, you mentioned the economy a little bit. But yeah. You talk about that. It's like one thing is the economy is really good for the. Well, I guess that discussion Does economy matter in a midterm election, or is it really just the presidential elections where that comes into play?
Well, this evidence shows that it matters in the midterm elections as well. And so that's why, you know, the ones that look in either, if you look at either change in real disposable income, which this does, or change in real GDP, which other studies have done, which is, you know, just general economic growth, it does have a very strong predictive power in terms of explaining the size of the midterm losses, which makes sense when you think about it. If you, you know, look at an election like 1998, I mean, the only reason that Clinton did so well is the economy was doing great. And we had, you know, that was what, the 8th year of the economic recovery. Stock market was great, unemployment was low, inflation was low, and people were happy with the state of the economy. And the impeachment thing then was just kind of icing on the cake, like, you know, what are the Republicans in Congress doing to, you know, try to impeach our popular president? But it was the state of the economy was the underlying explanation for why the Democrats did so well in 98. And contrast that then to an election like 1982, where the economy's, you know, in recession, and the Republicans, you know, took a bath in the 82 with that big recession. If we go back to there, so yeah, in 82 they ended up losing, you know, 25, 26 seats in the 82 recession. 94, the economy was, you know, not doing that well in 1994. And so in 2010, we're just starting to come out of the, you know, the big economic collapse of 2008, 2009. And so there definitely is a relationship there between the state of the economy and midterm elections. It's a bit stronger for presidential elections, but it's there for midterms as well, whether you measure it as disposable income or the GDP growth. But yeah.
Should the expectations of Democrats be tempered a little bit more, though, by how good the economy?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, yes. Yeah, no, for sure. No, and in fact, the fact that, you know, going back to the, so right, so if you had the, you know, an actual recession, so you're down, you know, in this territory down here, you know, then you'd be looking at, you know, 60 seat loss. But the fact that we have income growth around
2, maybe as high as 3%, it will temper those losses and make the losses somewhere more in the 40 to 30
range instead, according to the models anyway. So yeah. Right.
The problem is though, is that some people think that the economy is doing great, but other people, like with the tax law that just went through.
Right.
Some people think, oh, the tax law is great because we just got these checks, and other people say, well, but there's gonna be all this problem down the road.
Right.
Then we have this potential trade wars that are going on, but, you know, there's the long view and then there's the short view.
Right.
And so there's two views of the economy, right? And so it kind of depends on where you're sitting.
Yes.
As to where you think the economy is.
Absolutely.
So that's why,
yep,
it's hard to know if you're the 50%, 35%, 65%.
Right.
No,
for sure. And that will be exactly, I think, what the main issue in the fall election is going to be is, you know, the economy's doing, you know, pretty well right now, but are we mortgaging our future by having these huge budget deficits we're racking up? And especially if we, you know, started a trade war with China or something, you know, then that, I think, really would hurt the Republican Party if that were to happen. And so, I mean, the Democrats will be trying to make this argument that we don't have a strong foundation right now because of the large budget deficits that were just incurred from the tax cuts. And the question is, will that be a compelling enough argument to people who just got a tax cut and they have an economy that's relatively strong? And so that's going to be kind of, I think, the central debate in this election is going to be exactly that. So, yeah.
International crisis or successes.
Yeah, so, well, right, so that it can, certainly, and the best example of that would have been 2002 with 9/11 and George Bush. And so that's where, you know, after the terrorist attacks on 9/11, you see the Republicans and Bush.
It
was related, you know, the war on terror became very quickly an international issue, and, you know, we went and, you know, attacked the start of the war in Afghanistan and then Iraq, you know, after that. And so that quickly became a foreign policy issue. And so if there is something big like that, that can have that effect.
It was a great big swing for FDR in 42.
Well, true. Right, he did, yeah, so he did lose a lot of seats in 42. And I think, you know, at that point, the war, you know, still was underway, and, you know, it wasn't clear we were going to beat Hitler at that point. And so people were starting to get a little concerned. Another good example, I think, would be Lyndon Johnson in 66. I mean, he loses, you know, close to 50 seats in 66, just as the ramping up of Vietnam starts to go. The Vietnam War starts to become unpopular, you know, it's just beginning in 66 to become a little, you know, less popular. Then 74, of course, is Watergate. That's the big loss for Nixon in 74 is because of the Watergate scandal. And so often it can be some big event, either domestic like Watergate, or something, you know, like, you know, the Vietnam War or 9/11, you know, can be events that are definitely having an effect on the size of the seat swing. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, go ahead.
Speaking yes. Have you given any thought to the Mueller investigation?
Well, right. Yeah, when that's the Mueller investigation, you know, when he would have his report come out, I mean, it could have a huge impact on the midterms, you know, depending on, you know, if it's going to be the October surprise of the, you know, 2018 midterms. Yeah, it could definitely have a major, major effect. Now, on the other hand, if that doesn't come out till after the election, then it's still just speculation about what it's going to be. And so I think that would really tend to sort of limit the size of the Trump effect if the report, you know, hasn't come out. But it could make it just huge, absolutely. Yeah.
What effect does governorships have on national politics?
Well, governors would love it if they weren't tied to national politics, but you know, they would love it if they could say, you know, it's just about the politics in our state. But they are affected by national politics as well. They get wrapped up in the overall sentiment of the country, and they're able to insulate themselves to some extent. And one reason you see.
Governorships on...
Oh, I thought you meant the other way. Okay. Okay, yeah. Okay, so because the state of the economy and everything nationally clearly affects governorships, but the effect the other way, so could that have an effect? So it can, if you have like a really popular governor running for re-election who then can bring his or her supporters to the polls that then help House candidates or even a Senate candidate running in that state. And so it's a fairly, you know, idiosyncratic kind of, you know, case by case effect, but you can see that effect sometimes if you do have a really popular governor who's running. Like, you know, thinking again in our state, you know, the third time that Tommy Thompson was elected, he won something like 67% of the vote statewide, and so that helped all Republicans up and down the ticket when you have, you know, a governor that's that popular. Now that's fairly unusual, and so not going to be that many states where a governor will have that kind of coattail effect on House and Senate candidates, but it certainly can happen.
How would, say the Democrats pick up 5 or 6 governorships, how would that affect Germany?
Well, it could have a pretty big effect, especially if it goes along with the picking up some majority control of state legislatures, too. Now, you need to do both of those, you know, because that one graph I showed last night that showed where you get the big effect that's a bias in favor of one party or the other is when you have unified control of the state government. And so if you get a governorship and the Republicans would still have the state legislature, at least you would get a good, you know, balanced outcome at that point.
Because
you exactly. They could block a plan that the legislature would pass. And so that's why the governorships are really key in 2018, because that's the governor's going to be in power when they're redrawing the lines. Absolutely. Yep. Yeah.
I just wanted to know what the effect if the governor was really unpopular.
Well, no, true. That can have kind of these reverse coattails as well. Where if you have an unpopular governor who's a drag on the ticket, that could end up hurting House and Senate candidates in that party too, for sure. Well, right, they stay home instead from the governor's party, right? They stay home and don't vote.
My point question is going to be about the gerrymandering. When the court's taking a more active hand here in the last couple of years, you know, right in the midst of some of that, that could be big tonight in Pennsylvania.
Right.
Because they're voting different districts.
That's right.
And so it gets interesting from that standpoint. If you've done any review on that trend, it almost starts to feel like a wave that there's four or five states now that have had significant decisions on how you select the districts.
That's right. Yep. And in fact, voters in Ohio just 2 weeks ago, I think it was, approved a new nonpartisan process for drawing district lines. You had the state Supreme Court case in Pennsylvania that made them redraw the House lines. And then the Maryland and Wisconsin cases that we talked about last night, you know, we're waiting for the Supreme Court decision on those. But yeah, it could have a pretty big effect in Pennsylvania. The most estimates are that Democrats probably pick up about 3 seats maybe in Pennsylvania because of the new lines. And so if this does become a trend in other states and other state Supreme Courts step in, even if the U.S. Supreme Court doesn't, you could
see, you know, the effect of that, especially down the road, having an effect.
For sure. Yep.
All of his glory, that he will think that would be a beautiful thing.
Well, right now, it's something the Republicans are kind of struggling with on a case-by-case basis again. That there are some Republicans who don't want Trump to come campaign for them. And there are others where Trump is quite popular in those districts, and he'll be a welcome campaigner, you know, for sure in some areas. Like I could imagine, say, West Virginia. You know, I could imagine Trump coming into West Virginia and really helping the Republican nominee there against, you know, Joe Manchin. And so, but that's really going to vary on a case-by-case basis. Like in, you know, Wisconsin, you know, whoever the Republican challenger is going to be against Tammy Baldwin, I would bet they would say, yeah, stay home, Mr. President. We don't really, you know, want you campaigning for me in Wisconsin, because he's, you know, not that popular in Wisconsin. And certainly in a state like California or New York, you know, there for sure, any Republican who's running there would not want the president to come, you know, campaign in a state like that. But there are parts of the country where Trump is still very popular and would be welcomed by the Republican candidates.
So. And you look at that Alabama thing from the
fall. Well, right.
And how that was that split.
Yep.
Some of the stuff I've looked at looks like it was more just the Democrats did a much better job than anybody thought they would
in
organizing the, especially the African American.
Absolutely.
And they just came out.
Yep, and the turnout was tremendous.
It was a combination of, of those factors. But you look like Missouri now, and apparently that governor isn't going to have much going for him.
Right.
It's a very, very interesting state.
Yep.
So,
right, no, and that's actually a good example of the question about, you know, can governors end up hurting their party? And Missouri is a great example of that, actually, where you have a very vulnerable Democrat running there, Callahan, and the governor, though, I don't know if everyone's been following
that story or not, but it's one of these stories you just can't believe that's real. It's like, are you sure the Onion didn't come up with this? Because it just, you know,
So basically, he filmed himself having sex with this woman that wasn't his wife. And then threatened her, like, you know, don't ever tell anyone or I'll,
you know, didn't see it, kill her, but basically threatened her. And then, you know, this all has become public now. And this is someone that a lot of Republicans thought could have been a future presidential candidate. Like he was,
looked like a bright political future. Well, he's now, Republicans in the state are trying to get rid of him. Like they want him gone, and he refuses to leave. Right. And so this means that the Democratic senator from the state, who had been very vulnerable, probably has a pretty good shot of winning now. And so that is a good example of that kind of, case-by-case kind of unusual situation, Alabama being the other good example of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, so, any other questions? Anything? Good. Great. All right. Well, you've all been a great audience, and I've really enjoyed your questions, and I wish I was staying another week. This has been a lot of fun. So, yeah. All right. Thanks.